Today, over 100 million Americans are underbanked, meaning they use alternatives to traditional banking services like check cashing, prepaid cards, or payday loans. They do this either because they're barred from accessing regular banking products or choose not to use them. On today's first underreported segment, we'll take a look at the underbanked community and what proposals are on the table to remedy the situation. We're joined now by Melissa Cody, Deputy Director of the Asset Building Program at the New America Foundation. I'm very pleased to welcome her to our show today. Hello.
Hi, Leonard. Pleasure to be with you.
Are most of these people living check to check?
Most of these people are largely living check to check. The incomes of these households go up the ladder, but, you know, with the credit crises that's happened and job losses, we're seeing a lot more people who are in the position of, as you say, living check to check.
And I mentioned check cashing, prepaid cards, and payday loans. Is that pretty much the list of alternative services that the underbanking are using?
Well, I think it's helpful to also appreciate that it's the bodegas on the corners of, you know, cities like New York, where people go in and turn cash into checks. So it may not be an explicit check cashing facility. It's bill payment services that are oftentimes offered through local grocery stores. It really runs the gamut. Pawn shops are included, and they have been around for hundreds of years. So it's vast and it's varied. It's also the remittance services. It's a lot of non-bank financial services that are more generally regulated at the state level as opposed to the federal level.
Of the 100 million people who are underbanked, there's a subset of 40 million people who are unbanked, meaning they don't have any kind of bank account. Well, that's more than the population of California. Why is the number so high?
Well, it's high for a number of different reasons, and that's a hard number. It's a dynamic number, let's put it that way. But at any given point in time, there are approximately 40 million who do not have a bank account. It doesn't mean that they didn't want to have one before, or that they won't necessarily have one in the future. But for some of that 40 million, it's because they've had a bank account in the past and they've had bad experiences with it. There's something called check systems, which is basically an interbank cooperative system where if someone has a bad check writing history, they get put into the system, and then typically other banks who are a part of the system see that individual's name and won't offer a bank account to that person. The time period's about 7 years.
Banks also make it kind of difficult to open up some accounts, don't they? I remember the last time I went to a bank to open an account, I think they wanted my birth certificate or my passport or something like that. I said, hey, gee, I have a long history. Isn't that enough?
Yeah, no, it's particularly a problem for more transient populations, people who move from place to place, you know, for job purposes or, you know, moving with family. And it's obviously an issue for immigrants more so. And what this issue stems from, it's something that we've been doing a fair bit of work around, is the fact that there is something called the Bank Secrecy Act and the USA Patriot Act, which was passed after 9/11, that puts a lot of responsibility and ultimately liability on the banks to make sure that who they're opening accounts for really are who the individual says they are. They've got basically a requirement to verify that person's identification.
And that's because they are looking for illegal aliens and terrorists?
They want to make sure that the next, you know, Osama bin Laden isn't opening up a bank account or somebody who's going to be funding Osama, unfortunately. But for households, I mean, what's more important is that for households or individuals who, you know, have basic identification, but it isn't necessarily their Social Security card, they're not able to access a bank account because the banks have a lot of flexibility in the criteria they use to decide if someone is or isn't who they say they are.
Now, I would assume that somebody who is being funded by Osama bin Laden would find a way to get all the documentation necessary to open up the account, the person is going to be punished as somebody who really doesn't have many resources.
One would expect that's true. The other conflating issue with this is banks, of course, want to not only protect against funding the next terrorist, protecting against money laundering, illegal practices, but they also want to make sure that there aren't cases of fraud. And so you really have a lot of variability in what the individual bank's policies are for opening up accounts. We particularly when you think about the immigrant population, we have seen some more progressive institutions who are using what are ITINs, individual taxpayer identification numbers. These are numbers that people apply to the IRS to get in order to pay their taxes. Well, some banks like Bank of America have been more receptive to using these alternative numbers to get people into a basic bank account. We think, though, that there's a real opportunity to learn from some of the experiences in other countries where they have these problems, whereby you build a bank account and have policymakers support a bank account that perhaps has more constraints on how the account is used, how much money can go into the account, what the balance is, while allowing some flexibility or greater flexibility on what identification materials are required to open the account.
We're talking about underbanked communities on today's Underreported with Melissa Coyde of the New American Foundation. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Has the economic crisis increased the number of people who are underbanked?
It's increased the financial constraints and the challenges that are facing underbanked consumers. As a result of the credit constraints, people who had subprime credit may have had a credit card, but are now seeing the rates on those cards escalate. The credit crisis also is having potential effects in the providers of these alternative financial services. Because keep in mind, if you're a business offering remittances or if you're a business offering payday loans, you need a bank to provide your liquidity. And so it's even in that area that we're seeing some of the constraints play out and affect what the financial products and services are that the underbanked are able to access.
At its peak in 2005, the credit card industry sent out 10.2 billion solicitations for cards. That's more than the entire population of the planet. Were all of those solicitations to people with good credit scores? I mean, that's a silly question. I know the answer to that.
Right.
And now there are reports that major credit card companies are denying more applicants or trying to trim their customer list because of the economic crisis. Delinquency rates are up a third since 2006. So wouldn't it be even harder for many people to enter the traditional banking system right now, even if they wanted to?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think when we think about the underbanked population, what's really important to keep in mind is these folks are trying to make it from paycheck to paycheck, to your point at the beginning, and they're turning to various sources of small dollar loans in order to be able to do that. And I think I'm in Washington, D.C., and very importantly, what is the topic of the day is ensuring consumer protections. And we've seen big bills pass, particularly on the credit cards, to ensure consumer protection. But what I do and what we're trying to talk about tomorrow and make sure that policymakers understand is there is this underbanked population that needs access. And when policymakers employ things that promote consumer protection, we really have to think about, do we need counterbalancing policies to ensure access? And so one of the ideas that we're going to talk about tomorrow is the idea of a really explicit policy that would provide a guarantee for commercial lenders who provide funding for small dollar lenders. But small dollar lenders who make these, $500 loans, to people based on their ability to pay and what our fair and reasonable price is.
Oh, are we talking about the microloans? Muhammad Yunus's approach that he has brought to the United States. Do you think that a federal program could actually develop that kind of a system?
We do. We do think such a program could develop that kind of a system, because what ultimately is important is that the seed money is needed in order to provide the funding and the infrastructure that shows these commercial, large commercial lenders that there is a market, and that these micro lenders or these smaller lenders have the capability of successfully underwriting these consumers for these small dollar loans. So we definitely think there's some potential there.
And you're on a panel on discussion at the New America Foundation on shadow banking tomorrow. What is that all about?
Well, it's a little bit of a play on the term that's been circulated in this broader crisis. Typically, I think when people hear shadow banking, they think of hedge funds and private capital pools. This is also another aspect of shadow banking, i.e., not mainstream traditional banking. It's sort of a catchphrase to get lots of people in to hear about some of the policy ideas that we've got and we're putting on the table.
According to a study by the Pew Charitable Trust, even in Manhattan, 12% of households still do not have a bank account, which is lower than the national average, which is 8%. And that's in Manhattan, where there seems to be a bank or an ATM on almost every corner. So in many cases, the problem goes beyond whether there's physical access to banks, the sort of thing mm-hmm. that we've heard as a problem in the past.
Mm-hmm.
So what is it, you can give people the banks, but you can't make them come?
That is true.
Because in the past, hasn't there been a long history of banks avoiding lower-income neighborhoods?
There has to some extent, although we've got some pretty significant federal rules that require that banks actually make loans and service communities from which they take deposits. It's called the CRA, or the Community Reinvestment Act. But I just want to take your comment as a opportunity to talk about, technology is advancing new products and new ideas. And we're seeing new products emerge like prepaid cards, which are in effect bank accounts. They're issued by non-bank, they're issued by banks, but sold by firms like Netspend. And they've got a different structure where you don't have to walk into a bank branch in order to put money into that account. You could literally walk into your local Rite Aid and add money to that account. That type of flexibility and the convenience that you can get in terms of these alternative products have a lot of appeal for underbanked consumers, oftentimes households or individuals who are working two jobs and get off of the second shift job and need to go put money, into their account. But, of course, the bank isn't open at that point. So long as adequate consumer protections exist around some of these alternative products, we think that this is a really exciting direction in terms of providing financial services for the underbanked population.
Congress passed the Credit Card Act of 2009 earlier this year. Has that legislation had any noticeable impact on the people we're talking about?
It has, and as I was saying earlier, you pointed out how many billion solicitations were issued. Though you're right. I mean, you didn't have to say it, but those were
the 10.2 billion.
Yeah,
4 years ago,
prime credit. And while the industry will argue, and there are probably some kernels of truth to this, that this legislation is truly going to affect their ability to extend credit, particularly to people with subprime credit, it's also a real landmark in terms of putting in protections for consumers, making sure that it's plain English in the terms that go with the credit cards. preventing things like universal defaults, whereby if you're late on one credit card, another credit card issuer may raise the rates. That's a prohibited activity now. So it's got, you know, it's, as I was saying earlier, it definitely has made some important milestones in terms of consumer protections, but we then need to think about what policies are needed to counterbalance when it has negative effects on access.
Well, the Obama administration's been talking this week about overhauling the financial regulatory system.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us about the proposed Consumer Financial Protection Agency? What
Yes.
would it do?
It would do a lot, as the Obama administration has proposed it. It would, in short, create a federal agency that has sole mission of protecting consumers in terms of their financial products. It would have authority over banks, depositories, credit unions, and the myriad of other financial providers, including many of those that we've just been talking about. It would write the rules regarding what adequate consumer protections are in the financial services industry broadly. And then it would allow states, because again, I mentioned that these financial services are largely regulated at the state level. This agency would allow states to then enforce the federal rules as well as make their own decisions if the federal rules aren't high enough to then add additional rules to it.
Well, despite general agreement that health care in America is in serious trouble, we can't get any kind of consensus on what to do about it or whether we should do anything about it. Are you any more sanguine about this sort of thing? It sounds like the sort of thing that a lot of Congress people will get up and start screaming about, calling
they
it social.
Yes, you know, it's I believe that this agency really would set some important landmarks on consumer protection. I think some form of it is going to come to be, but I think that there probably are going to be some significant compromises. One of the ideas that is really novel that was proposed with it would be that issuers of various financial products would have to offer plain vanilla version of whatever that product is. So if if you offer mortgages, not only can you offer your exotic mortgage products, but you also need to offer your plain vanilla. That was really problematic, has been problematic for industry. The complaint is, of course, well, this stifles innovation. You know, this clearly may not be the product that my particular consumer niche wants or needs. It's likely that that idea is probably going to be off the table. But what this agency, if it does come to pass, will likely include is much higher standards in terms of disclosures so that consumers really can understand what the terms, what the conditions, and what the costs are of the products that they take on.
Do you think we'll ever get to a point where loan sharks won't be an attractive alternative for a lot of people?
Well, I would hope we could get to that day, but the consumer segments are really varied, and where there's a demand, there's typically a supply.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us today. I've been talking about the underbanked with Melissa Coity of the New American Foundation. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you as well.